It's Wednesday afternoon at 2:06. I'm Bill Nigut. This is Political Rewind. You're listening to the So Long Presidential Candidates edition of the show. We've come out of Super Tuesday with just so much to talk about, a really exciting night. Let me just give you a little sample of what the morning papers had to say. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution said that Trump and Clinton are rolling on. Washington Post on the front page said, a nightmarish Super Tuesday for the GOP establishment. New York Times, GOP split widens the chasm. Wall Street Journal, Republicans face moment of truth. Trump's victories pose conundrum for GOP establishment. The New York Daily News front page had a little sticker that said, it's the end of days guide to fleeing the country. Remember when you said you'd leave the U.S. if Trump were elected? We don't blame you, and it's time to start planning. And finally, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian John Meacham, in an interview, said, we may have seen the last Republican president of the United States, George W. Bush. Wow. I mean, really, the establishment really up in arms about what happened across Super Tuesday. This was a very good night last night for Hillary Clinton, of course, and for Donald Trump. Donald Trump won 39% of the statewide vote here. Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz really, really close in the numbers, although, as we'll discuss in a little while, Ted Cruz got a few more delegates than Rubio did. And on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton won 71% of the vote, continuing her domination over Bernie Sanders in states, of course, where there are a lot of African American voters. We're at Politics GPB. If you want to tweet us and share your feelings about what happened last night, we'd love to hear from you. In the meantime, let me welcome our panel of insiders, Democratic consultant Howard Franklin. Thanks for coming in today, Howard. I have a feeling that a lot of this is going to be talking about Republican politics, and you'll just have to weigh in as you get a chance.
Sure thing.
Brian Robinson, he's the former communications director and deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. He is now a government affairs guy working at the Capitol and elsewhere. Brian, it's great to have you here. Eric Tannenblatt is back with us. You all know that Eric Tannenblatt's been active in Republican politics in the state of Georgia and across the country for a long time. He was a Jeb Bush man, raised a lot of money for Jeb Bush. And as he said to me a little earlier, it's nice to kind of be in here in a role where you don't have to just talk about one candidate, right?
That's right.
And we also want to welcome to the table for the first segment of our show today, guy who's got a lot to be happy about last night, Brandon Phillips. He is the Georgia State Director of the Trump campaign. Brandon, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
How did you, aside from the fact that there has been this enormous groundswell of interest and excitement about Donald Trump, how did you put together this victory in Georgia?
Well, I wouldn't say I put it together. It's certainly a movement. I'm just the guy that kind of does the air traffic control and puts the pieces together. We did start back in last fall building a ground game, contrary to popular belief. I can't speak to other states, but we were very intent on building one here in Georgia, and I think we accomplished that. We organized in 159 counties out of 159. We were the only campaign to do that.
Really, even more than Ted Cruz?
Yeah, Ted Cruz put out a press release saying he organized 100 counties and was very proud about that. So when we did 59 more than that, I think we were even prouder.
Yeah. And what were the messages that you found resonating here the same as it resonated across the rest of the country? An awful lot of people in exit polls in Georgia, I think more than 40%, said they're angry about the way government is being run. Is that consistent with what you were hearing?
Yes, sir. And if you combine angry with dissatisfied with Washington, you put that together, it's almost a supermajority of what they're looking for. And Donald Trump fits that bill to a T.
Brian Robinson, in the final days of the campaign here, final week or so, there was a great effort, and you were part of it, to encourage more elected officials, people like Jan Jones, the Speaker Pro Tem of the Georgia House, and others, to get on the Rubio bandwagon. It just didn't come together, and the Trump folks just seemed to have the momentum they needed to make a success out of last night. Yes?
Yeah, and as far as that grassroots effort went, we were very successful. The Rubio campaign got more local official support, more legislator support than any other campaign in the state. No one ever pretended that that translates directly into to votes. But what it does show you is that many elected officials are worried about having Donald Trump at the top of the ticket and what it's going to mean for us. I don't think it's going to be devastating necessarily for people in Georgia, but for people like the senators from Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Illinois, I think it's going to cause some serious troubles for senators in those swing states, those purple states, and some blue states. It's going to be really hard to distance themselves from our nominee.
Brandon, you know, and you said your advance, I don't know if your campaign isn't actually doing real polling, right? The Trump campaign, Trump has said over and over again, it's not polls he pays attention to. But you had some indication, one way or the other, that Fulton County, DeKalb County, and Cobb County were not likely to come Trump's way last night. Why do you think that happened? I'll start with you, but I'd like to bring everybody else in. Why were those counties doing well for Rubio? Did they put him over the top and decide not to vote for Trump? What's the makeup of those counties?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, if you look at the four counties that Rubio won, they're obviously the more moderate counties here in Georgia, like Clark County. That's certainly no bastion of conservatism. So I think that gives you a little indicator of his candidacy. But yeah, we don't do any polling, but what we did start back in the fall was doing ID calls. All right, so we made 2,500 calls between Christmas and New Year's Day. And then we started that all the way through, started January 1 to now. We made just over 123,000 total calls with 900-something volunteers and averaging almost 1.5 hours per call. So you spend a lot of time talking to live people, Georgians, and asking them what they're looking for, who are they looking at, what are their issues. And you call all that data and you go and turn out the people that you...
So you believe that Rubio won in the Georgia counties and precincts where more moderate Republicans live? Is that basically what you're suggesting?
Yes, sir. I don't think it's any secret the makeup of the electorate in some of those metro counties, and particularly Clark County.
If that's true, Eric Tannenblatt, as the campaign moves toward Illinois, toward Ohio, toward Michigan, where we presume voters are not quite as uniformly conservative as so much of Georgia is, what does that forebode about the Trump campaign? He's still going to do incredibly well in those states, yes?
Well, it all depends. You know, I don't think this thing is a foregone conclusion. I mean, yes, you know, Donald Trump had a great night last night, but, you know, we're still early in the process. And these winner-take-all states, there's still time for other candidates to start stacking up some of these delegates in the winter. And we could end up going into the convention with no one having the majority of the delegates. So I think that we need to sort of step back and take pause and not just get caught up in the media hype, which, you know, we've now experienced for the last 8 or 9 months about Donald Trump.
Well, maybe, but Brandon, there's a smaller and smaller window for a Rubio or a Cruz or a Kasich, and we'll talk about him in a little while, to win the nomination from Donald Trump, isn't there?
Yeah, I think the media hype is, you know, less on Donald Trump and more on there actually being a brokered convention. Let's just go back. If there were a candidate, McCain or Romney, that were to win three states in a row after Iowa, they would have been saying this thing's over with. Then you go into Super Tuesday and you win seven states, and the next guy wins three, and the next guy wins one. Again, they'd be saying, this is over with, everybody get out. So I think the fact that it is Donald Trump, you're a lot of pundits and people who make a living off of politics and the media like to drag this thing out and pretend that this thing could go into a contested convention. I just don't think that's statistically likely.
Well, but this is not like any other election we've experienced, partially because we have a candidate like Donald Trump who has spent less money than any of the other candidates, significantly less, and has gotten the media attention and coverage. Plus, I mean, you're dealing with someone who for the last 20 years has been a national celebrity. And, you know, there's some brand identity that he brought to the table that some of the other candidates didn't have. They had to pay for it. And so you can't really just look at the past and say, well, this is how things are going to work out in the future. And so I think this is a very different election. And the way that the RNC has structured the process this year, with proportional states going up to March 15th, does allow for this to be a longer longer period of time leading up to the election and giving other candidates a shot.
I would tend to agree with Eric. I don't know if there is a question, to your point, Bill, about any of the other remaining Republican candidates winning the necessary delegates to clinch for the nomination. But I do think there is maybe an end game where they prevent one candidate, say Donald Trump, from clinching and then trying to figure out how this broker convention actually does work. And obviously, when you get to the convention, you've got not the entire electorate out there, you know, making this decision, but a smaller group of folks who do seem to be fairly unified in their opposition to this one candidate.
Brian, you're a veteran of Georgia political campaigns. Let me read you some figures that I think are fascinating from last night. Donald Trump won 499,385 votes in the Republican primary here. So he won 500,000 votes. Overall turnout on the Republican side was somewhere around 1.28 million people who voted. And on the other side, 740,000 Democrats voted. So you've got an almost 2-to-1 margin. Well, more than that, you've got about 2/3 of the people who turned out were Republicans. So what do those numbers tell you, first of all, about Trump's strength? He did win 39%. That's a pretty significant margin. But he didn't win enough to stop Rubio or Cruz from passing the 20% threshold to each get some delegates.
We have several things going on here. And one, let me say, as somebody who does have the scars on his back from numerous statewide Georgia campaigns, all the credit in the world to the Trump team. I mean, hats off to you. Y'all have done it. Y'all have won in places where 3 months ago, no one thought you would possibly be even competing. So hats off. I mean it sincerely. Congratulations. But here's what's happening. That was a monstrous turnout yesterday. You're almost kind of proud of Georgia voters for the way they turned out. I mean, it was absolutely extraordinary. I think that you've got a 38% of Georgia Republican voters who were just going to get to the polls to vote for Donald Trump if there was an ice storm. They were somehow going to get to the polls to vote for him because I think his followers are very passionate. I think the other 62% were equally passionate about getting to those polls to vote against Donald Trump. They weren't there because they're wild about Cruz or Rubio or John Kasich or Ben Carson. That's not what it was. It was an anti-Trump vote.
And you don't think the Cruz people?
I think some of the Cruz people probably are pretty diehard. But
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But for the most part, that 62 is an anti-Trump coalition vote, in my opinion, and it's divided up between all these candidates. And so the argument for Rubio and Cruz moving forward is, if we get a coalition candidate, Trump can be stopped before the convention. If they all stay in, it's going to be really hard to make that argument.
All right, we're going to hold that part of the conversation until after we get a break in. But while we have Brandon here for the next couple of minutes, Brandon, I'm going to play just a little bit of the Trump news conference. That was fascinating in and of itself, the optics, as we now say, around that he held last night when he'd already won a number of states. Listen to what Trump told the crowd about how he sees himself moving forward.
Look, I'm a unifier. I know people are going to find that a little bit hard to believe, but believe me, I am a unifier. Once we get all of this finished, I'm going to go after one person. That's Hillary Clinton, on the assumption she's allowed to run, which is a big assumption. I don't know that she's going to be allowed to run. And I think that's frankly going to be an easy race. You see the polls. I beat Hillary in many polls. I know one thing. I don't think Marco's going to be able to beat her. I don't think, in all fairness, I think Ted's going to have a very hard time. But Ted at least has a shot because at least he's won a little bit. So I just tell you this, we are going to be a much finer party, we're going to be a unified party.
Brandon, after hearing that speech last night, Newt Gingrich tweeted, "Trump's shift toward inclusiveness, team effort, and unity was vitally important. He has to build a Reagan-like inclusiveness to win this fall." Now, Gingrich is not endorsing Donald Trump, but Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions has now endorsed him, and obviously Chris Christie has endorsed him. It looks like two things are happening. One Is it possible that Trump is moving more toward a strategy of general election campaign, a message for the general election? And two, is he, by making the kind of comments he did last night, courting those establishment Republicans who have been opposed to his campaign?
Look, I think what he said was what he said. He is trying to unify the party going forward. That's what you always do when you get through a bitter primary. Primaries are tough. They're meant to vet candidates, and you move into the general election and bring people together to win in the general. He's won in the North. He's won in the South. He's won in the Midwest. He's won in the East. He's won with evangelicals. He's won with moderates. He's won with conservatives. He's won with women. That's the type of candidate that grows the Republican Party. Brian hit the nail on the head when you're talking about increasing the turnout. The turnout, not just Georgia, in a lot of these states has been phenomenal. That's the kind of guy that brings those Reagan Democrats and the Reagan coalition back into the fold. Those are the guys we want in November. Those are the guys, those people, those voters that the pundits claim that we didn't have with Romney and that we're losing because people stayed home. Don't we want a guy that will turn people out in the general?
All right.
Trump's shown he can do that.
Brandon Phillips, really appreciate you. I know you had a late night last night, and I'm really grateful to you for coming in and sharing your thoughts on Political Rewind today. We'll stay in touch with you as the campaign moves forward. Thanks so much for being here,
Bill,
Brandon.
And Jordan, thank you all very much. Appreciate it.
We're going to take a break. It's 2:22 on Wednesday afternoon. When we come back, we'll have Brian Robinson, Eric Tannenblatt, and Howard Franklin. We'll continue to discuss the campaign. And Brian Robinson's already networking. Let's take a break.
You know, Chip, jobs are supposed to pay the bills. That's why they're called jobs.
That's comic Louis Anderson playing Zach Galifianakis's mother in the new FX comedy series Baskets. On the next Fresh Air, Anderson talks about taking on the role and drawing on his own mother for the character. And we'll talk about his stand-up comedy, which draws on dark autobiographical material. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
It's Political Rewind at 2:22 in the afternoon. Democrat Howard Franklin, Republican Eric Tannenblatt, and Republican Brian Robinson. Brian, did you get your work with Brandon? Did you get the card before? We were still on the air when you just... But you got what you needed.
I did.
I just want to make sure. Yeah. We want you to be happy.
Yeah. So, okay. I love winners.
Let's go to that. What's going to happen as this campaign moves forward? Look, I think you can say two things at the same time. You can say, number one, Trump did have a blowout night last night and is marching toward becoming the presumptive nominee. But you can also argue that there is some path left for another candidate. But are we going to start seeing more establishment Republicans fall in line with the Trump campaign?
I think watching the discomfort, the constipated look on Chris Christie's face.
Oh, my God. Somebody said it looked like a hostage video. It did.
That may have tempered some people's desire.
Yeah, what we should say, if you didn't watch it, we're talking about when Trump came out for his news conference at the Mar-a-Lago. Is that the name of it? Yeah. Chris Christie introduced him and then stood by him very uncomfortably for about 20 minutes or so. Go ahead.
As Trump talked about how great Planned Parenthood is, when Chris Christie's talking about how bad Planned Parenthood is for a solid month, it was gold. You are going to see a trickle of people. I think there was rumors last night about Florida Governor Rick Scott endorsing, and then his spokesman walked it back. But there's still that rumor out there, and that would be really devastating for Marco going into the Florida primary if that happened. But I think that the establishment as it is speaking out against a potential nominee in a way that is unprecedented. You know, like Peggy Noonan, who was the famous Reagan speechwriter, tweeted out last night, "We are watching the end of a great political institution." And you're hearing that sentiment out there a lot. And right now, you know, Jeb Bush's former communications director, Tim Miller, has now moved to a super PAC funded by billionaires whose sole purpose is to destroy Donald Trump.
Yeah, they've already produced a two-minute spot which absolutely savages Donald Trump. We don't have time to play it, and a lot of it's visual, but If you want to, see a really, really tough spot, you can go Google it. It's the pack again is, what's it called? Everybody remember? We'll find it out and put it out there.
I just was going to mention, I mean, this is truly full circle. You've got a candidate who rose to the front of the Republican nomination process by eschewing the establishment. And now you see just like Brian said, a handful of establishment endorsements. But I think, as we've seen with Trump over the last several months, all he needs is two or three to say he has the greatest ever, right? He'll take the few that he's gotten and make it seem like he's gotten all the establishment behind him.
Yeah, and Bill, you talked about Trump having a blowout yesterday.
Well,
you
know, seven states is a lot of states.
So what would it have been called if he beat Ted Cruz in Texas, which he didn't, or if he won Oklahoma, or if he won Minnesota? So I think, you know, this again is part of the problem, is that the media is helping, and I'm not accusing you, but this is, you know, this is an example of what the media is doing and the hype. And you talk about the endorsements of mainstream Republicans of Trump. Well, let's talk about Senator Sass saying, I will not vote for him if he's the nominee. And there are other Republican leaders that are stepping forward saying, I will not vote for him. So I think you have to be fair and look at this. And I think Brian made a really good point earlier, in that, you know, there's 60-something percent of the voters that rejected Donald Trump last night, that voted against him or voted for another candidate.
So we know that your former candidate, Mitt Romney, has now announced he is going to be giving a speech about the state of the Republican race tomorrow. His people say this is not going to be an endorsement, nor is it, I think, a last-minute entry by Mitt Romney into the race. But can't we expect he's going to have something to say about where Donald Trump is taking the party?
Well, I don't know exactly what he's going to say, but I do know that Mitt Romney is probably one of the most, if not the most well-respected Republicans we have in the party right now. He was our nominee last time. He hadn't endorsed any candidate yet. And I think a lot of Republicans are going to look to what he has to say.
All right. Brian Robinson, Ted Cruz is making the claim, staking his victories last night, saying, I'm the only one who can really take on Donald Trump. Rubio didn't do very well. Let's listen to what Ted Cruz told his Texas victory party last night.
Tomorrow morning, we have a choice. So long as the field remains divided, Donald Trump's path to the nomination remains more likely. And that would be a disaster for Republicans, for conservatives, and for the nation. And after tonight, we have seen that our campaign is the only campaign that has beaten, that can beat, and that will beat Donald Trump.
All right, you heard Ted Cruz. Brian, before I get your response to that, let me report to you and to our listeners some news that literally just broke a moment ago. The New York Times is reporting that Ben Carson seems to be suggesting that now is the time for him to withdraw from the Republican race. The quote is, he sees no path forward. That's not going to make a whole lot of difference at this point. He's been performing very poorly in the last couple of races, right?
Right. So he woke up from his nap, said that, and then went back nap.
Kick him when he's down,
come
Brian.
Yeah. Brian, he just got out of the
ring. All right.
I'm sure, you know, I'm fascinated by Ben Carson because he's obviously a genius. I mean, just one of the most phenomenal biographies you're ever going to see.
All right. Is Cruz right? Is Cruz,
no,
look,
Cruz is
Rubio
not right, no.
didn't, Rubio won Minnesota last night.
Which makes what Cruz said untrue.
Well, at the time that Cruz spoke, Minnesota
right, yes,
hadn't
true,
come
true.
In.
Yeah.
Okay, be careful. All right. Right. But so isn't Cruz
He's
right?
Partially right.
Okay.
The partially right is I do think that part of why we are where we are is because we had so many candidates. And as much as I wanted to see Jeb Bush be our nominee, I thought he did what he needed to do after South Carolina. He lost and he got out.
Yeah, it was an honorable decision on his part, you'd have to say.
And I think that, like what Dr. Carson did today, I think if we shrink the field down and once we get this to a two-man race, I think that you're going to – there'll be more of a likelihood that you know, you won't necessarily see the outcome of Donald Trump just winning everything.
Is that a likelihood, though, at this point? It sounds as if each of the remaining candidates, you know, say for Dr. Carson, has made a decision that they're going to stay in because they believe.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Howard. And let's talk about that. I'm going to play you something that Marco Rubio told George Stephanopoulos on ABC last night. Before I do, let me just make sure I said that correctly. The Times reports that Ben Carson seems to be suggesting this may be the time to get out. It is not a done deal, but we assume they wouldn't be moving the story if they didn't have some information he was doing.
Do you want to dial back your comment?
So, you know, Howard, you just sparked the next soundbite. You know, Marco Rubio, over the course of this campaign, has found a way to spin gold out of straw. You know, he's right out of Rumpelstiltskin. And here's what he told George Stephanopoulos in an interview at the end of the night on ABC News last night.
I think the question tonight is, what happened to Ted Cruz's Southern strategy? He was supposed to win Iowa, which he did, South Carolina, which he didn't, finished third, and then all these Southern states. And instead, tonight, the only thing he won was his home state of Texas and the neighboring state of Oklahoma.
He's beating you pretty handily.
And he had to share delegates there as well. Well, in his home state of Texas, sure. But here's the bottom line. If you look at the map from here on out, it gets better for us. This was supposed to be it. His whole campaign was built on the Southern strategy. It didn't happen. He lost them all, except for his home state.
All right, Brian, you have made it pretty clear, at least through the Georgia primary, that you think Marco Rubio is a good candidate for the Republican nomination. You have a great picture that you posted with him the other day.
I was his driver, yeah.
You were his driver. Yeah. But Brian, isn't his statement last night, he may be the best guy in the race, but isn't the kind of statement he made last night exactly what voters are rebelling against? Tell it like it is. You lost. Say, I had a bad night, but I'm going to do better as we move forward. He didn't do that. He tried to suggest that Cruz didn't have a good night.
Well, see, this is where Trump's really changed the rules of the game. What Rubio said is what everybody in his position has said for time eternal, that there's still a pathway for me. And that is the message that he has to drive it. He has to keep his people up. He has to keep them engaged. He has to keep donors opening up their wallets. He can't just be like, things are looking really bad, because, you know, that's going to really slam the brakes on the campaign's momentum.
Or he could acknowledge what seems to be the case and get out of the race. Like that, I think he could have said the same for Bush.
But see, here's why not. I agree with what I was going to say, what he said when Bill brought this up before. Look at where Rubio has done better. He won in Minnesota. He finished a really strong and pretty close second in Virginia. If Kasich weren't in it, he would have won Virginia. I know that's, you know, if, ands, and buts. But we're moving now into those states. This Saturday, every primary is a closed primary. Trump has lost 3 of 4 closed primaries, and that means that Democrats can't vote, that you've got to be registered in the party to vote. So Trump has not done well in those. So Saturday could provide some interesting results if those patterns hold true.
All right. Let's do this. It's going to be we'll watch. You know, right now, you've got two primaries ahead on the Republican side, and then let's talk a little about the Democratic race. So next Tuesday, on March 8th, Eric, we've got a vote in an election in Michigan that I would suggest has some import, because John Kasich has been entirely missing from most of these conversations and written off by an awful lot of people in the media. The reality is, he said from early on, not from the start, that he thought his strength was going to be when the campaign turned to the Midwest, to the Northeast, and he's run his campaign exactly the way he wants to. He hasn't been diverted by all the other stuff, the Michigas, as we say, going on with the other candidates. Is there a path on March 8th, if he does well in Michigan, for him to be once again considered a serious contender before the 15th, when we have Florida and his home state, Ohio, voting?
Sure, but I am not optimistic that's going to happen, because, you know, this reminds me of Rudy Giuliani in 2012 or 2008, when he said, you know, I'm going to focus on Florida. When you're out of the limelight and no one's paying attention, I mean, John Kasich can be spending every day in Michigan right now, but no one knows it except the people he's in front of.
I tend to agree. I mean, I actually like John Kasich. I think
That's his problem.
You mean the Democrats like Howard like him?
Hey, I think he's probably still the only guy thought of as an adult in the room. And I think that that's a lot of what he's banking on. And I think there's obviously this mythic of inference that Ohio carries this outsized import to Republican voters, and no Republican president's run without it. And I think if he is successful in Michigan, he'll look to translate that success to another win in Ohio, and then start to stump on the idea or the fact that he's the best chance at actually ensuring that a Republican makes it across the finish line.
All right, as we turn to the Democratic race, I tweeted earlier today from Politics GPB a question about whether or not the Georgia GOP was time to accept Trump is going to be the nominee. We got a tweet from Rusty Hogan who said, "I'm interested in who y'all think Trump's VP might be." That must send shivers up your spines, Brian and Eric, to even think about that. Yeah. I don't mean who he picks, just the notion that maybe he'll be in a position to have a vice presidential nominee. Yeah.
Look, we still got a long ways to go.
All right. Yeah. All right. So on the other side of the fence, we had a big, big victory. I don't think anybody, Howard, would argue, as Brian did about the Trump victories, that this was a big night for Hillary Clinton.
I absolutely agree. I think bigger than a lot of people expected. I also think largely because there was a lot of news coverage about the investments that Bernie Sanders initially was making in South Carolina. At some point, that stopped. And obviously, those same investments didn't make it to these other southern states. And so once it was clear that a campaign wasn't actually being waged here, although I will tell you, I saw a few folks in Midtown yesterday holding Bernie sign, which I thought was hilarious. I was standing on the Beltline. But once it was clear there wasn't going to be a real battle for these electoral votes, Hillary just kind of ran the table.
Absolutely. Why don't we listen to just a short excerpt of Hillary Clinton's victory speech? She, like Donald Trump, was in Florida. And here's what she had to say.
America prospers when we all prosper. America is strong when we're all strong. And we know we've got work to do. But that work is not to make America great again. America never stopped being great. We have to make America whole. We have to fill in what's been hollowed out.
As I watched this toss-up question, you're all welcome to grab at this. As I watched her speech last night, I thought, this is a speech, finally, that Hillary Clinton has been longing to give for a very long time. I mean, she's had other victories, but the Super Tuesday results bring her closer to being the presumptive nominee, and I'll certainly listen to any of you think I'm wrong. And she got a chance to get up and essentially give that speech that she was denied in 2008, trying to bring the party together and to start making her claim for why she'd make a better president, specifically than Donald Trump. That seemed like a fair characterization of what we saw last night?
I think she's relieved because she has had a rough go with an unelectable opponent. And that says volumes about where she stands, not only with the national electorate, but even with her own Democratic Party. People coming out of those exit polls say they trust Bernie Sanders more than her by a 90-10 margin. That is devastating for someone who's been in public life for 30 years. Here's what Republicans need to think about. We finally have a really vulnerable Democrat nominee coming our way. The electoral math is really hard for us to start off with. Democrats have an innate advantage in the Electoral College. Our candidates going head-to-head with Hillary are beating her by small margins, but beating her nevertheless. All candidates except for Donald Trump, who is losing to her by a significant margin. We are giving votes to the guy most likely to hand this to Hillary Clinton on a silver platter.
That's a good point. And earlier there was a discussion about the new people that Donald Trump is bringing in to the party and who voted for him, people that turned out that hadn't voted before. But keep in mind, that's in a Republican primary. And when you get to the general election, there are demographic groups that will not vote for Donald Trump. because of some of the comments and his actions that he's taken throughout this campaign. And Brian's absolutely right. I think Republicans really need to look long and hard at who is going to be the nominee that is going to have the best shot at beating someone who can be beat.
So, Howard, I see two sides of that coin as well. On one hand, it appears that Hillary Clinton does have right now. I mean, she is on the path to the nomination. And on one hand, the polls suggest that Trump would be underperform compared to Rubio or Cruz against her. On the other hand, Trump has surprised us over and over again. This group, all of us, last year, in the middle of the year, were saying Donald Trump's a joke. He's never going anywhere. I'm not sure you can underestimate him as a general election candidate, except, again, to go back to the other side of the coin, all of the excitement about Trump, as Eric points out, has come from one party, from a Republican Party. Democrats haven't weighed in at all on this guy.
Well, I would just say I think there's some credence to some of this. I would say comparing this primary process that started out with 15 or 16 Republican candidates to a head-to-head general election matchup is a false comparison. I think before Super Tuesday, I want to say I read that Donald Trump had gotten about 33% of the Republican electorate who had turned out to vote. And after Super Tuesday, he's up to 34%. I think that there still is a ceiling. And if we're talking about the whole of the American electorate, I think Hillary Clinton stands a great chance and has a very strong advantage.
I'll tell you what, Eric, I want to, if you don't mind, please hold that thought. We're going to take our final break of the program. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. We'll also frame it with what Donald Trump had to say about Hillary Clinton at his news conference last night. It's Political Rewind at 2:42. We'll be right back.
How will the results of Super Tuesday shape the race for the White House?
We're taking from the Democrats. We're taking from the independents.
This campaign enters a new phase.
The political process.
We're so excited about what lies ahead for us.
So much. What a Super Tuesday.
We analyze who won, who lost, and what it all means for the rest of the presidential primary race. Later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 until 7 on GPB.
All things considered, as Bradley George just said, coming up at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Eric, I want to get to you, and I want to frame the remarks that you're going to make about the possible matchup between Clinton and Trump around the way that Donald Trump talked about Hillary Clinton last night.
We're going to make America great again, folks. We're going to make it great again. And, you know, I watched Hillary's speech and she's talking about wages have been poor and everything's doing badly, but we're going to make it. She's been there for so long. I mean, if she hasn't straightened it out by now, she's not going to straighten it out in the next 4 years. It's just going to become worse and worse. She wants to make America whole again. And I'm trying to figure out what is that all about. Make America great again is going to be much better than making America whole again.
All right. Eric, your take on what this possible matchup looks like.
Well, I think what Hillary Clinton was doing is she is trying to appeal to the Bernie Sanders supporters, because come general election time, she needs all of those people, because that's a group of people that, you know, maybe Donald Trump thinks because Bernie Sanders has brought all these new people in, these angry people, that he's just going to automatically attract them. And I think if Hillary Clinton continues with that message, she's going to have a better shot at attracting those voters than Donald Trump. And let's keep in mind, Donald Trump has offended the Latino community. He has offended women. He's offended the disabled. I mean, he's going to have to reach out to a whole group of people that he has offended, and that's not going to be as easy as he thinks.
Howard, last night at another point in her victory speech, Hillary Clinton said, I want to use a phrase that you don't often hear from candidates. I want to talk about, I think we need to learn to love each other. We need to basically care about each other. I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but that's what she was saying. Trying to run a positive campaign is not going to be an easy thing. And trying to talk about love in the environment we're in right now.
I don't know if I agree with that, Bill. I think, obviously, there's a lot of oxygen for the type of campaign as an outsider that Donald Trump ran against his male counterparts who are Republican candidates. I don't know if he'll get as much leeway day in and day out saying things that are unflattering or that could be seen as attacks against a woman. And who knows? I mean, he has, as Eric has already pointed out, has gotten away with it in the past, but I believe there are a number of folks who will come to Hillary's aid, who will point out these abuses and will make it very difficult for him to keep the same tone and temper. And I think if you look at, and I think we talked about this a little earlier, I guess Newt Gingrich already pointed this out, he is starting to point a little bit more toward an inclusive vision. So I don't imagine
This moment.
Sure, for this moment. My point is just, I don't think he could sustain a campaign where he's attacking other men and obviously a dozen of them in much the same way against Hillary Clinton.
I think I heard this morning, I don't know on what show it was, where the Donald Trump wouldn't hold back from bringing one of Bill Clinton's former girlfriends up on stage.
I mean, Brian,
I don't see how that hurts Clinton necessarily or Hillary Clinton necessarily, but who knows?
Well, Eric just led me into what I wanted to ask you about, Brian. I mean, if we do see Trump and Clinton as the nominees of each party, this is going to be one of the most vicious presidential campaigns ever. Well, I mean, maybe we go back in history to Andrew Jackson or, you know, something like that. But this is going to be a vicious campaign, isn't it?
Oh, it is. And one thing that's going to be, I think, interesting for Georgia is very few people in our circles in Georgia think about this, but in 2012, Mitt Romney won Georgia, but it was the second smallest margin of any red state in 2012. Only North Carolina had a smaller margin than we did, and North Carolina had gone for Obama 4 years before. So we are already in that marginal area with a strong Democrat candidate. And if a lot of Republicans decide to stay home in November of this year, this may attract a lot of Democrat money. And if there's a third-party candidate that emerges because these are the two nominees, you know, the last time a Democrat won Georgia was 1992 when Ross Perot was on the ballot. So I think this really opens up a pathway for the Democrats. I hate to say that. I don't want to spin that. But that's my fear, is that we're going to open up this state, and it has been such a strong, reliable Republican state for so many years now. We're putting that in danger.
I also think that we need to remind ourselves we're electing the President of the United States, the Commander-in-Chief, and we don't want to have a general election that looks more like a reality TV show and a food fight.
All these things, I think, resonate with certain segments of the electorate on the Republican side. I think the question is, what is the true ceiling for a Donald Trump? In a field with a dozen candidates, 30+% makes you the leader. But down to 3 or 4, will it continue to give him the margins of victory he needs to clinch a nomination? And if it gets down to 2, will he hold at that 34-39% number? That's my question.
So let me go back to the drama that is unfolding. Excuse me. There's a drama that unfolded in Washington the other day. You had Speaker of the House Paul Ryan get up and make a statement in which he talked about, we cannot afford to have a candidate for the Republican nomination. We can't afford to have a Republican nominee who's not willing essentially to turn his or her back on bigotry. Brian, commenting on Donald Trump and the trouble he got into trying to explain the KKK and whether he's for him, against him.
He needs to look into it a little bit, find out who they are, find out what their history is.
Understand the group.
Yeah. So, yeah.
But here's what's interesting about it. He did not condemn Trump. He didn't even bring up Trump by name. And he did leave a door open to some extent for possibly embracing Trump, because he said, and I think Mitch McConnell followed suit, they're going to support the Republican nominee.
What else can they say? I think his comments were actually very courageous. They were very forward-thinking. I was very proud of Speaker Ryan, and he is a great voice for this party and what it must be relevant and to survive into the future. He's saying the right thing, striking the right tone, and leaders like him had to stand up when the front runner for our nomination says he's not too sure about the KKK, whether they're good or bad. Thank God somebody stood up. Thank God Nikki Haley stood up in Atlanta and said, This does not represent Republican values. This is not who we are. I am a daughter of immigrants. That is what this party is. We are inclusive. This is about the American dream and making the American dream possible for the next generation, no matter what their background, no matter what their religion, no matter what their skin tone. That is who we are as Republicans. And I'm so proud that we have so many people standing up to say it.
Howard, go ahead.
Brian's absolutely right. And, you know, the speaker, I've heard him say this several times, that he does not want to involve himself in the middle of the presidential primary. But there's been two incidences, the one you just cited, and then last time when Donald Trump made that idiotic, you know, proposal about locking our borders off to all Muslims. And the speaker came out right after he made that statement and made it perfectly clear that that's not what it is to be a conservative. That's not what it is to be a Republican. And he is passionate about it. He is the messenger for our party. And as Brian said, you know, I too am very proud of him taking a stand like that.
Howard, it strikes me that the Trump problems with dealing with the Klan this week are, boy, they're just ready-made for that general election attack commercial. It's Willie Horton in reverse. And you can imagine the Democrats buying thousands of points in key states around the country with that spot.
And I mean, this is the danger of a Donald Trump. You know, you never know what he might say or what he might, you know, find to be. I don't know. It's a question in my mind as to whether or not he's making these policy decisions on the fly, or if he really hasn't made any commitment to tying himself down to policies in general. I think this entire experiment we've gone through with Donald Trump has been interesting that way, and I think there's plenty more to step into once you start to consider the scope of the country and the planet. Well,
but we should, on the other hand, say that Hillary Clinton's not in the clear herself in terms of the investigation, the FBI investigation. The Justice Department is in this awkward position where they very well might, under one scenario, have to decide whether they would indict the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party or let her off the hook. And either scenario is not a great one for Hillary Clinton, right, Eric?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's possible we could, you know, end up with Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and an indictment. I mean, it's...
Oh, my God. And it would not be surprising because this has been the strangest election year
ever. It has been.
That's right.
So let me, just a couple minutes we have left, let's do a little bit about the state. And let's segue by talking about presidential in the state of Georgia. Eric, partly because Jeb Bush was so highly respected by a lot of elected officials in Georgia, and also because you worked very hard to make sure that they got to know him well. You had a big, big group. He had the most endorsements of any candidate for on the Republican side early on. Do you see those people? Are they going to Rubio here in Georgia now? Are they dividing between Rubio and Cruz? Will some of them end up with Trump? What do you see happening?
Well, you know, Jeb's been out of the race a little bit over a week. There were a good number of them that went over to the Rubio campaign.
Right.
I hadn't really seen many shift to other candidates. Probably Rubio is the candidate that I saw most of the show. I haven't seen any of them shift over to Donald Trump.
Yeah. All right. Let's keep it with you for the last couple minutes and bring, obviously, you, Howard, and you, Brian, into this thing. We're in the final days. We got, 10 days left, 9 days after today of the legislative session. And the religious liberty bill will not go away. The controversy seems to be getting hotter and hotter as various people weigh in on this thing. Metro Chamber, Georgia Chamber have been adamantly opposed to it, continue to be adamantly opposed to it. Now some folks are suggesting that the film industry here could have a negative reaction. We're the third largest state in terms of revenues from production. Mm-hmm. But actually, Brian, let me go to you because you had to deal with this as a spokesman for the governor last year. Yes. I mean, is there going to be the speaker? The governor this week said, I'm working on it. Are we going to see a compromise that we have reason to think will be palatable to all to those who think this is damaging to the state?
A week and a half ago, he said we're still working on it. And then he followed up in more recent days and said, I am not going to sign a bill that allows for discrimination. There is a way to accommodate the needs of people of faith without writing discrimination into the state code. Speaker, Ralston also spoke up and said, look, I went home to Fannin County, which is hardly a hotbed of liberalism, and they're saying, you know, this isn't the juice isn't worth the squeeze. This is going to send a bad message about who we are as Georgians. It's going to cost us in our economy. It's going to cost jobs. It's not worth it. Let's find a better way of getting this done.
I'd agree with Brian. I think if there is more heat drawn to this conversation, I think it's coming from the folks who are opponents of RFRA. I think the Georgia Prospers Coalition has gotten stronger and stronger. I think, you know, you've got folks, other business leaders who made, you know, Mark Benoit from Salesforce. I think Twitter today or yesterday came out and said they are also opposed to it. So I think the strength in numbers is amassing on the opposition to RFRA, not necessarily for the folks who are pushing for it.
Plus, you know, having your state be the subject of a New York Times editorial that is read around the world. And I just got back from overseas, and I actually had someone from overseas ask me about the state that I lived in. And it was kind of embarrassing. And so that kind of publicity is not the kind of publicity we as a state want from an economic development standpoint. It killed Indiana last year. Indiana is still having a hard time recovering from it. It hurt in Arizona the year before that, and we do not need to be the next state on that list.
Yeah, you know what's got to really be troublesome to people like the speaker and presumably the governor and to some of those who wanted the Pastor Protection Act, which is the least problematic of all of the measures, there was an out. The leadership was giving members who were worried about going back and running for re-election, facing conservatives who said, you're not defending our liberty, that in a way the Protection Act was designed to give them an out and to settle this thing calmly. Instead, the hardcore conservatives just pressed forward and insisted on a more ambitious bill that many people see as prejudicial. It's troublesome for a member, I think.
Look, here's something that people who are against these bills don't want to talk about for obvious reasons, but I think it's a good point and a salient point. It is perfectly legal in Georgia today to discriminate against the LGBT community.
Yeah, we don't have an anti-discrimination statute.
So there's no law that's going to make a pastor do that ceremony. No law to make a florist to sell them flowers or a hotel owner to rent them a room. None. You can do whatever you want. And what this does is take state law from being silent on discrimination against LGBT to saying, we're actually, you know, we're okay with this. You know, we're going to look the other way. And there's no need to put that in state law. The purposes that they seek to accomplish are already the status quo.
Well, tonight on Lawmakers at 7 o'clock live, we're going to have one of the authors of the bill that's most controversial, Senator Greg Kirk, will be here, and we'll ask him whether he thinks it's time to back away from his position on this. I suspect we already know his answer. We're out of time for today's show. Eric Tannenblatt, Brian Robinson, Howard Franklin, what a pleasure. Thank you for being here on a great day after Super Tuesday. Lawmakers is on the air tonight on TV at 7 o'clock. I invite you to join me for that show. We'll be back on Friday for another Political Rewind. And Jim Galloway, who has been working very, very hard over at the AJC on the Super Tuesday election, will be back with us. So will Kyle Wingfield from the AJC. Beth Shapiro comes back. It should be a fun show. I'm Bill Nygut. We really appreciate your being with us. See you again Friday at 3 o'clock.